Welcome to a special edition of Life Talks. Today, we're going to be discussing the repercussions, the fallout of the Dobbs case and the overturning of Roe versus Wade. I'm Ben. I'm here with Dan. We are two of the teaching pastors here at Life Fellowship Church here in Cornelius, North Carolina. And Dan, I know we recorded a couple episodes, maybe a couple months ago, about the potential of this.
Yeah, it was right after the leak.
So, but now we know what has been written. We know what the opinions are, and we are now walking, you know, knee deep, head deep into the reality of this decision. Where we are seeing that the froth and the foment of certain people, angry. Mobs. I mean, I just recently heard a chant, you know, if Roe's not safe, neither are you. I mean, it's just crazy.
They're actually writing that one on crisis pregnancy center doors, sidewalks, and walls all over the country.
And there was a crisis pregnancy center, I think a Christian pregnancy center out in Colorado that was burned down or at least attacked this past weekend. So a lot of things going on. And I don't want to spend a lot of time on the necessarily on the legal issues. I want to spend more time on maybe spend a little time on the legal issues and then more on the application. Okay, what does this mean? How do we continue to move forward? So, Dan, just give me your thoughts on when it came down and when you read and heard the opinions that the justices had written. What were your initial thoughts?
Yeah, Roe versus Wade was decided when I was 12 years old. So this has been most of my cognizant life, you know, where I was plugged in. This has been the defining political issue for people like me of my entire lifetime. I cannot overstate the significance of this in terms of how I functioned politically to the point where there were many times I was at absolute despair. Including, you know, even, you know, a lot of cynicism on my part when Trump began appointing these Supreme Court justices, because I'd watched Reagan appoint Sandra Day O'Connor. I had watched and Anthony Kennedy. Mm-hmm. I had watched Bush the First do David
Stephen
Souter.
Breyer
was a Democrat.
Okay.
But then John Roberts, who, even though he voted to support the Mississippi law, let's make sure we understand, he did not vote. In fact, he voted to uphold Roe versus Wade.
Yeah.
So,
because originally you heard it was 6-3, but really it was
6-3
on the 5-3-1.
Yeah,
basically.
It was 6-3 on the Mississippi case, and it was 5-4 on the overturning of Roe versus Wade.
Okay.
And so he continues to track toward the middle, being more interested in his historical reputation than he is in the rule of law and principle of conservative values as an originalist. So, yeah, this was huge. I mean, I can't tell you, you know, just the joy I had. And it's a symbolic victory. It's symbolic because Roe versus Wade was the, you know, the placard chant, so to speak, for all these years. It doesn't change all that much, but I think it at least marks a temporary shift, but it also creates an actual crisis in this country about what we're going to do with life. When are we going to define it as valid, and how far are we willing to go? And these are the questions that are now going to be moved down to a local level, to the state level, where the Constitution provides they should be. But I don't think it's over there. I think there's another issue that has to be addressed by the court. I just don't know whether the court has the courage to address it or not. And that is whether or not we fundamentally have a right to life. And if we do, when does life begin?
Yeah. So, I mean, it's kind of what it's done is it's taken off the right to abortion.
Yes.
And it's
making us deal with the real things.
The real thing. Like, okay, now, because I've heard arguments on the left side saying, well, now it's taken away our democratic, you know, opportunity. And really, it's become more democratic, because what we're saying is people can elect representatives to make laws to either codify abortion access or to codify right to life. And I think that's really what I see is states are going to get redder and bluer.
I think that is happening. And I think the more that that happens, the greater the danger of maintaining a unified country, even practically, politically, you know, geographically, comes. I don't know if it's in my lifetime or not, but I do think it can create a flashpoint at some point if we're not careful.
Yeah.
Particularly if they start, you know, economic threats and following through on those between states, that's going to cause a lot of conflict. Mess with somebody's pocketbook and they get upset. But the thing, though, that I think that we need to be real careful of during this time is, first of all, the emotions are so high, and emotions often lead us to irrationality. Mm-hmm. I think for most people right now on the pro-life side, we want everybody to remember we're still here, but I don't want to get overly engaged with all the emotion we're seeing on social media and the media. That'll die down, and then you can have productive conversations, mm-hmm. but not until the emotion dies down. I think if you'll step back and look, you know, they always say, follow the science. Well, unless it's inconvenient to, you know, what I want to do. There's a lot of logical arguments that stand firmly on the side of the pro-life argument. Mm-hmm. And I think we have to continue to make those. I think there's one thing that we backed away from doing that we were doing in the 80s and early 90s that I really, and I'm a little bit of a firebrand on this. Little bit.
Really?
Yeah. But I think we need to introduce people again to the realities of abortion. Mm. You know, for instance, I put a picture of an abortion on my Facebook several years ago, and media got tagged and taken down because it was considered to be too violent. Mm-hmm. But this is the reality.
Yeah.
I mean, the other stuff I see on Facebook is, to me, far more offensive and far. But no, this is a political issue, and so they really censor it. Mm-hmm. But I think it's time for us, particularly when we're talking about late-term abortions, partial birth abortions, these kind of things. These are human beings who can feel, respond, react, recoil. And they induce pain into them in order to terminate their lives. By every definition, it's infanticide. By every definition, and by the way, the law, since Roe versus Wade was decided, the period of viability continues to move closer and closer
right,
to the
exactly.
point of conception.
Yeah.
So, and it's interesting.
If you follow the science keeps showing earlier and earlier that life begins at much earlier stages.
Yeah, and we all know, I mean, there is that point where life is real. Mm-hmm. If we found a two-celled organism on Mars, you know, through one of our every headline would say, "Life found on Mars."
Life on Mars. Yeah. Yes.
So, and by the way, if somebody were to dare go up there and step on that life, they would absolutely lose their minds.
Yeah.
That's the hypocrisy of the left. Absolutely slays me at times when you've got, you know, vegans and animal rights activists, you know, screaming loudly for the termination of human beings. But that's the emotion part, and so we've got to step back. We need to deal with it scientifically. We need to deal with it biblically, but we also understand many of the opponents of life don't come from a biblical worldview and reject it outright. So we have to make our arguments to them perhaps in a different way.
Yeah, I think it's important that Christians in this moment really, I had a statement that I read to our church yesterday. I really think it's important because most of us, I'm almost glad for the leaked
I think that
in
worked
some ways,
against
it,
them.
It really did in some ways.
It's
it
like
kind of took
some of the air out of the
balloon.
It
took the teeth out of a lot of the reaction because I think people were expecting it. But, you know, I said this yesterday, and I think this is why I'm having such a hard time with this right now, is that I never thought this day would come, Dan. I mean, I never did.
Yeah.
And yet here we are. And so part of me is just kind of like, I feel like, is this real? Is this really happening? And I know that overturning Roe does not make abortion illegal. Again, it's frustrating when I see people on the left who are, you know, these single young white women living in these blue cities, you know, screaming, you're taking away my rights. I'm like, you live in New York City. You have nothing to worry about. You know what I mean? But which I think there's just so much misinformation going on right now. But I almost feel like, what do I do with this?
Yeah.
And I think that it reminds me of how important, laws are, I'm thankful for the overturning of Roe versus Wade. But I said this yesterday, and I think it bears repeating. We need to understand that if hearts are going to change, they change through a number of different ways. They change through relationship. They change through the exposure of truth. And I think that we've got to understand that the gospel changes hearts more than anything. And so learning how to dialogue instead of argue, learning how to build relationships. I know we've had Josh Brom on our podcast a couple of times. Mm-hmm. I think he does a great, great job with the Equal Rights Institute that he leads. He's a part of our church. He has a lot of great stuff on his website. But I just think we need to get back to having more conversations, more building relationships, and more exposing to the truth. Because to me, it's like, you just said it, logic, science, truth, it just seems like everything is on our side of this issue. We just have to cut through the emotions and say, let's have a real dialogue about this. And I think if we know what we believe and know how to express what we believe, and we actually are intentional about building relationships with people who don't agree with us, I believe we can see a great movement of change happen in the streets. Because the reality is, abortions will still happen in certain states as long as people elect representatives and governors who say, hey, we want to have abortion. And what you're seeing is, the I said this earlier, the blue's getting bluer, the red's getting redder. The blue states now, like you said, you know, California, I forget. I mean, they're literally
Oregon,
I mean, it's becoming partial birth or right after birth murder at this point.
And some of that is an overreaction to, you know, the Mississippi law. And part of it is, in, you know, I'm not trying to be crude, but it's flipping the middle finger at the pro-life group.
Right.
They have the power in those states, and they're going to use it.
Yeah.
And to some extent, you know, conservatives do it as well. You know, Oklahoma, their attorney general's an awesome guy, and it resonates completely with me. But, I mean, they're kind of say, and by the way, we're coming after you if you sell the pills.
I've heard some of that, yeah.
One of the things I would just encourage our folks is to spend some time educating yourself to the argument. You mentioned Equal Rights Institute, and I think that's one of the best sources to go that. So many of the arguments that I've seen play out on social media are so specious. The issue of, you know, if you haven't adopted, you don't have a womb, you don't have a right. All these reasons why you're trying to marginalize your ability to speak into this, and you know, none of those hold up to logical arguments. If you apply that, you know, to other topics,
it's so interesting, because I was even listening to the BBC, which is, you know, British Broadcasting Corporation, and they're interviewing the Oklahoma Attorney General. And he says, "What makes you as a white man, you know, have the right to tell a woman what to do?" And it's just kind of like, well, when did all of a sudden we have to be, you know, we have to have a certain skin color or gender to be able to speak for? I mean, it's just, I don't know when that argument came into being, but it's very odd to me that this is now.
And the ironic thing is that there was a woman and there was a black man who were, you know, on the right side of this. You know, and you know, the thing that saddens me, but also impresses me, sometimes you wonder, what's it like to be on the Supreme Court?
Yeah.
What are these people like? These people are incredibly strong people. They knew exactly what they were signing up for.
Yes.
These are patriots. You know, even I've, because of some friendships and relations I have, I've been able to spend some time with some federal judges and Supreme Court. When you talk to them, they talk about the collegial atmosphere. It's real. It's real. I had a wonderful conversation with someone who's an Obama appointee. We don't agree on anything, but they were just genuinely nice people. But I will tell you, when it comes down to making their decisions based on their legal principles and how they view the law and so forth, they're unshakable. So all these people calling Clarence Thomas, you know, Uncle Clarence, or using the N-words all over Twitter, where they're using the N-word, usually young white women again, which just really reveals a racism that's pathetic. But, you know, I stood in Clarence Thomas's office, my wife, me, and him, just the three of us. We talked. This was 15 years ago plus. But we talked about the pressures that he's under. And he has this huge booming laugh. And he just, you know, chuckled. And interesting, all along his walls were editorial cartoons of his hearings that Anita Hill. He has them framed and on his walls in his office, or at least did at that time. So every day when he walks in, he's reminded of what he was put through to get to his seat. But he had this huge booming laugh, and ha ha, you know, just booming. And he said, "Dan, let me just tell you what the Supreme Court justices think about what the media says about us and what people in the general population losing their minds over." He says, "We don't give a damn." And I'll never forget it, because I mean, it really was. We were talking about everything from who's going to retire next, these different things. And, you know, you have to be careful, because you have to respect the office. And so you don't ask a lot of intimate or personal questions, but it's just Dan, you know what, we're here for life, and we're set.
And that's the whole point. The whole point of that office is that it's not motivated by
politics. Yeah,
it's politics or the masses.
Yeah, and they want to. Susan Collins was pitching a hissy fit because she said, "Well, you know, they lied to me whenever." You know, first of all, it's unethical for them to say in advance how they're going to rule. Secondly, the fact that they're asking where would you stand on this issue is not only unethical; it's political.
Yeah.
So if they're making decisions based on their qualifications, it's one thing. If they're making them based on how Are you going to align it with me politically? That's politicizing it. And that's what the founders didn't want us to do.
Right.
And they shouldn't put the Supreme Court justice candidates in that position. It did not happen until Edward Kennedy did it for Bork.
Yeah,
Robert Bork. Whenever he was in 1981 or two or whenever it was that he was nominated. And from that point forward, Kennedy broke down serious walls on how Supreme Court nominees were handled. And it has turned into the circus that it is today because of him. Mm. So again, I think all of us who are engaged in conversations, thoughtful conversations with people, need to do our homework. We need to understand why people respond the way they do. And you know, it's not enough to put a meme up on your Facebook wall with a verse of scripture. I know, you know, fearfully and wonderfully made. That's true. We all believe that and so forth. But that's not going to convince anybody. It's certainly not going to convince a young atheist woman.
Yeah.
I tell you the people it's important to have the conversation with, it's the people that live under your roof.
Absolutely.
Because when you send your kids to public schools, I guarantee you, when you send your kids off to college, I'll guarantee you that 99% of the messages they get from people in authority are going to be, you have a right to choose.
Yeah.
And if you don't counter that, teach that, explain that from a biblical sense, from all the different, you know, appropriate worldviews, if you don't do that, you're going to lose the battle, and you're going to one day wake up and look on your daughter's Facebook wall, and she's going to be promoting the exact opposite of what you believe.
Yeah, I think that's really important, is that don't assume just because you bring them to church that you raise them in a quote-unquote Christian home that they are going to have your values. They're going to be drinking from the water, and even social media. They might even be homeschooled, but if they're drinking the waters of TikTok and Instagram and social media, they can be heavily influenced by those things. And so, you know, I just think it's one of those realities that parents, make sure that you are teaching your kids what the truth is, and that you're educating them, because, man, the world will if you don't. I think that's really important. So I have a question for you. What do you do with, I know this is, we've had conversations about this, but immediately after this happens, you hear all the big companies, Apple, Amazon, I mean, I could list them all. They're going to pay for all their employees now to fly, and it doesn't matter where they live, they're going to fly. Should that register for us as Christians? I mean, what did that do for you when you heard that? How now it's almost like corporate activism that seems to be ramping up, especially with this issue. What are your thoughts on that?
Great question. And my view on that is a matter of individual conscience, but I will tell you my conscience. I wrote the list of those people down. Mm-hmm. I've researched it. I've updated it. And I'm actively trying to avoid, when possible, it's not always possible, but actively trying to avoid using them. Mm. Like, for instance, Starbucks is one of those companies.
Right.
I was done with Starbucks before. I'm really done with them now. I've got choices on where I can buy my coffee. I don't have to buy. I've literally had meetings in Starbucks where I sit there with a glass of water because I'm not going to spend money at Starbucks. Mm-hmm. But I'll use their Wi-Fi. But at the same time, if I need a ride share, both Lyft and Uber have said they will do it. So I don't have a choice there. Mm. And, you know, I need to get to where I'm going. So, I mean, some people say, well, that's hypocritical.
There's hitchhiking, Dan. Come on. Be consistent.
I really love Jesus, I'd walk. But for me, it's a matter of two things. Stewardship. Yeah. I want to be accountable for how I spend all my money. And secondly, it's my way of raging against the machine. Mm. This, to me, is the greater danger. What government can't do constitutionally, corporate America, corporate world, is now doing on their behalf. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And this is what I believe, and I don't want to get too deep into the theology, but whether you're amillennial or dispensationalist or, you know, whatever position, I believe, when you look at John's epistles, particularly 1 John, what you see is the Antichrist world in play.
Yeah.
And there may be a person, but there's definitely a system.
Absolutely.
A person needs a system.
Yeah. Yeah.
So whether or not there is a single Antichrist or not, I'll let all the eschatology nuts, you know, debate that. But we can't debate whether or not there is not an anti-Christian, anti-Christ, anti-truth system.
Yes.
And for many years, many people thought that was going to be the government. I no longer think that. I think it's going to be the business,
the financial
industry, the, you know, corporate world.
Yeah.
And the same thing will have to happen, I think, to Christians. It happened even during the days of the guilds in the early years of the church.
Right. Yeah.
Is that you create an underground economy as much as possible.
Yeah. I mean, I think that all of these are things that we now need to think about, and we're navigating these waters in a post-Roe world. But Dan, I just think as we as we end our conversation, I just think it's really important to understand there's a lot more work to be done.
Yes.
I don't think that we should rejoice in this moment, but understand it's not like we're like, okay.
Yeah.
You know,
job's done. Job's done. What's the next thing we're gonna do?
So I think in some ways what the decision of Roe versus Wade did almost 50 years ago was it normalized abortion, so that now that it's taken away, the majority of Americans still at some levels think that abortion should be legal. Now, what's interesting is most Americans believe that abortion should be legal. But most Americans also believe that abortion shouldn't be legal after the first trimester. Yeah. So I mean, it's a very
you've got to break that question down a lot. Like some people say, yeah, it should be legal if the life of the mother is going to be at risk. Yeah. You know, there's a lot of nuances.
Yes, yeah,
and that's what makes this so difficult. But I would say, you and I live in North Carolina.
Yeah,
North Carolina, we do not have a trigger law. We do not have a pro-life state. We're kind of a purple state, but we had the opportunity when we had a Republican governor and a Republican House and Senate, and they muffed it. They didn't do it. Mm. So I would say in North Carolina, we have an opportunity right now in this coming election. I think it's 3 House seats and 1 or 2 Senate seats, and they have Republicans have a super majority. So that means they could override
anything
Cooper's veto, and he would definitely veto it. Mm-hmm. So some people were saying, well, yeah, we can't wait for 2 more years to get Cooper out. Well, first of all, we have a history of Democrat governor, so that's not a gimme. But we could see that if we elected the right, you know, even in Huntersville right now, we've got a big race, Bradford, and Christy Clark are running for state house. Christy Clark knocked out the one, and then she got knocked out by John. John's going to be pro-life. Christy is extremely hard left. So even in our own district, we have an opportunity, and I think it's really important that all of us educate ourselves on local politics, because now it is local.
Yeah, that's good. Well, hey, I appreciate you guys joining us for this conversation. You know, one of the things I would encourage you to, if you have questions, if you have thoughts, or just you're uncertain about what this really means, Dan and I love to talk to people. I know many of you share your thoughts with us on Sundays when you see us. But don't let this moment be a cloudy moment or a moment of shock to you. Really ask the Lord God, how do you want me to continue to be pro-life, pro-Christian, pro-God in our nation today? And so we'll encourage you to continue to walk in the spirit of truth. And thank you again for joining us on this episode of Life Talks. We'll talk to you next time.
You've been listening to Life Talks. Be sure to hit the subscribe button so you never miss a new episode. Share this podcast on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter to let your friends and family know about Life Talks. We'd love to hear from you as well. So leave a comment and let us know your thoughts on this episode or any other topics we've discussed. Life Talks is a ministry of Life Fellowship in Cornelius, North Carolina. For more information on Life Talks or Life Fellowship, visit lifecharlotte.com, or you can find us on Facebook at Life Fellowship Charlotte.